Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode 39 of the Musician's Mentor Podcast. I'm your host, Travis Mark, and today I have the distinct pleasure of talking to Nashville-based songwriter to the stars, Brent Baxter. Brent has had cuts with Alan Jackson, Lady Antebellum, Randy Travis, Joe Nichols, and a host of others. He also co-hosts a great podcast, which I suggest you check out, called The Climb, which stands for Creating Leverage in the Music Business. Brent's just a great advocate for original songwriters and the art of songwriting in general. So make sure you check out the links in the show notes. Make sure you check us out on TikTok, since we're trying to do that whole thing. And don't forget, as usual, to please leave us a rating or review on your preferred streaming network. But for now, ladies and gentlemen, the one, the only, Brent Baxter. Brent Baxter, thank you so very much for joining me on the Musician's Mentor Podcast. I obviously know quite a bit about you. I've listened to your podcast for years and I've checked you out and I know your songwriting. I'm a big fan, so privileged to have you here. I will do an introduction post this interview, but what I typically do with most of my guests is I ask them to do a little bit of a brief introduction on themselves so that the listeners hear it from the source and potentially get a better idea of where you might be coming from during the course of this interview. So, with that being said, if you wouldn't mind, tell the world who Brent Baxter is.
Yes. So, as you said, my name is Brent Baxter. I'm a professional songwriter. I'm a lyricist by trade. Been in the music business since like 2004. I got my first cut after a couple of years after I moved to Nashville. I got an Alan Jackson song recorded, a song called Monday Morning Church. Ended up going top five on the country charts for him. So a successful single really got me in the music business. That was my first cut in the business, and it really kind of introduced me to Nashville. And so been the victim or the proud holder of several publishing deals, several cuts along the way by people like Randy Travis and Joe Nichols, Ray Stevens, others here, you know, in the U.S. and in other countries. Also, I have a couple number ones in Southern Gospel, right? So gospel, country, bluegrass, kind of whatever I can get my hands on. Also host a community called songwritingpro.com. It's where I'm just kind of turning over some of the lessons that I've learned from my time in the business and share it with songwriters who want to write like a pro, do business like a pro, and connect to the pros. Also, as you mentioned, my podcast also co-host a podcast called The Climb. It's an acronym, stands for Creating Leverage in the Music Business. So I've been doing that for like 6 or 7 years now. We have way too many episodes. I've been doing that for a long time, but it's a lot of fun, so we keep on doing it. And yeah, so write songs and try to help other people write and connect to the business, and it keeps me busy.
Incredible.
So that's the short version of it.
That's great. That's absolutely incredible. We will obviously dissect some of the career and the introduction as we go. But I figure, you know, since I've got the opportunity to talk to quite an accomplished songwriter, I'm going to stay in that vein with you rather than get into some of the nitty-gritty music stuff that I talk to with some of the other guys that I talk to.
Yeah.
And girls, you know. So I want to kind of back up a little. I read that when you were growing up, you would write short stories and that you'd grown up in Arkansas. And then you discovered songwriting while you were in university. So this was quite fascinating to me because, you know, most people seem to, I don't want to say that they will have these similar paths, but most of them do have these similar paths. They've been bands, they dabble on guitar as kids, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I want to know, how did the discovery with songwriting for you come about? And then how soon after you discovered this, did you decide that maybe you could turn more attention to songwriting to make it your career?
Sure. Well, I'd always been writing. I'd been, back when I was in, you know, elementary school and junior high and that sort of stuff, I was always just making bad puns. They were just called corny puns. These days we call them dad jokes. I was doing that since I was a kid, playing with words, playing with, you know, turns of phrases and just that sort of stuff, just playing with words. I read comic books as a kid. I used to make up my own characters, draw my own comic books, and write my own comic books just as a hobby. And that was kind of a dream of maybe one day I could work in that industry just because it was creative and I enjoyed doing that sort of stuff. Started writing bad poetry sometime in high school, you know, just because of girls or whatever. And just, again, working with words, writing short stories in high school, also like science fiction, superhero kind of stuff. And so that was just, it was something I enjoyed doing, creating these worlds, creating these characters, these events, all this stuff, capturing that. And so it wasn't until I was a sophomore in college, I went to Arkansas State University, and a buddy of mine from back home, we were both really into country music, and he had gotten a guitar for his birthday, like in October, and this was December, I was on home on Christmas break, and he took what I thought was one of my poems, but it was structured just like a lyric, had a repeating chorus. I didn't recognize it as such, but he took it and put a melody to it, and he played it for me. I was like, oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And I was hooked from then on. And it's funny because now that I think about it, most people, when they start off trying to write lyric, it's more like an unstructured poem. And I was writing a poem, but it was structured like a lyric, and I didn't really realize it, you know, because I've been listening to music for years, listening to songs, so it was just kind of in there. So this one just kind of came out that way. And but I was hooked as soon as my buddy Tim, when he put melody to that lyric, I think for a couple of reasons. I think it was collaborative. Right. Instead of sitting in my room by myself working on a short story or whatever it was, it felt like, OK, I have a buddy that I can enjoy this with.
Yeah.
Which is fine. I've never co-written a poem or short story. And so this, we get to work on this together. We're both really into music, so that's fun. And then he could play it for people and it could get out in the world. You know, he just played around our hometown some. He was still in high school at the time, but it could get in front of people and get a reaction. My short stories, basically, I would turn them into my honors English teacher, and I get some extra credit. And other than her reading it and my mom reading it, that was about it.
Yeah.
And so it was fun that, like, these can get in the world some. And this was in the mid 90s. So, like, Garth Brooks was huge and, you know, really into that music and just that era of country music. And so it really didn't take long. I mean, because I knew I'd rather do something creative than. I was in school for a business degree.
Okay.
I didn't really want to do that. There's nothing I really wanted to do there. But when that hits, like, maybe that's something we can do. And, oh, there's this job that you can do this? And so it didn't take long before that became, like, the dream job.
Yeah.
Miles away from it, years away from it. Didn't know what I was doing, but that seed was planted that, yeah, I want to do that because I don't want to be a cubicle.
Yeah.
Basically. Yeah. I don't want a real job.
That's awesome. So, you know, eventually you end up in Nashville. Talk to us about how that transition from Arkansas and all of that happened. And then tell me how the decision came about, like, if there was such a decision, a conscious decision, as to what your strategy might be once you got there.
Sure. So, you know, I was already in college when Tim and I started writing songs together. And so he's my main co-writer for a long time, but basically all the way through college. There'd be another person or two I'd bump into to write a little bit with them, but he was kind of my main guy. And when I graduated actually from grad school, I got my master's in business, and I guess I still was putting off the real world. I don't know. But I was looking for jobs in Little Rock and then also in Nashville. I was hoping to get something in Nashville. Didn't get anything in Nashville, got some in Little Rock. But hey, my buddy Tim, my co-writer, he was around there going to, like, I don't know, pre-med or pharmacy school or something there. I guess pharmacy school at the time. And so we were still continuing to work together. And I was started making some trips to Nashville, I guess, when we were both still in college, like in 97. Instead of spring break going to, like, the beach, we went to Nashville. And we went to the Bluebird, and you know, he tried to play the open mic there. Being a lyricist, I'm the words guy. I don't play an instrument very well. I don't sing well. Like, I left that to Tim. Let him do that part of it because that's what he wanted to do. And he was way better at it than I was. So that was like spring breaks and summers. We'd go to Nashville and we'd camp out or stay at somebody's house. My uncle's mother-in-law, so my aunt's mom, lives in Nashville. And so we'd stay with her and we'd go in, or we'd go get at a campground and just, you know, stay and do the tourist thing and try to figure out the business side of it. So we were doing that for a few years. And then in Little Rock, we both ended up there, and then we went in together on making an album for him as the artist.
Cool.
And so we co-wrote, you know, I was on 12 of the 13 songs on that record. And so we, you know, we co-funded it together, and this is going to be my, you know, our thing that we'd present to Nashville. And so I had joined NSAI, so National Songwriters Association, members there. So I'd send songs off to get critiqued. We'd go and we'd try to get meetings there, meetings at ASCAP, which is one of the performing rights organizations in the U.S., and just trying to, you know, so I joined ASCAP, joined NSAI, and just trying to get a foot in the door where I could, looking for jobs in Nashville, nothing really happening. And then finally, and I was just chomping at the bit. I was dying to get to Nashville. I was working in a cubicle in a call center and just hating it. I tend to hate every job that's not songwriting, by the way, that I've ever had. But I was hating it, and I was writing songs and just trying to figure out how to get to Nashville. I met some people in Little Rock that were trying to start a publishing company. They knew a publisher or two in Nashville. So we had connected just through me and my buddy Tim just kind of shaking the bushes and being active in Little Rock. And there wasn't much of a music scene there at the time. But through them, met a publisher in Nashville, got my first single song contract, and which was super exciting.
Yeah.
And, starting to get like, okay, I know somebody in Nashville. I know a publisher now. And eventually just, never did find a job in Nashville. But what happened was, so my uncle's mother-in-law, so my aunt's mom lived in Nashville, and she had a room open. She rented rooms out after all the kids moved out. She would rent rooms to people to just, make some income.
Yeah.
Well, one of the rooms came available, and I did the one thing I said I wouldn't do. I moved without having a job. And, which, I said, I'm not going to do it because I'm too, conservative for that. I'm too, level headed for that. I'm not doing that risky thing. I'd had enough. I'm like, I'm doing it. She said, I can mow the yard to help work off my rent. I can just rent a room. I'll go get a job there. And so I moved to Nashville and, interviewed for a job at Blue Water Music, which is a publishing company in town, and they also admin a bunch of other people's stuff. And I didn't get the job. I was really disappointed by that because I was a fan of that publishing company, knew a lot of their catalog and their writers, just because I was a fan of what came out of there. Didn't get the job. They gave it to someone else, and then I went and got a job waiting tables at Cracker Barrel, which is another thing I said I'd never do. I'm like, I'm not going to wait tables. I waited tables. And like a week later, Blue Water called me back. The other person didn't work out. They wanted to know if I was interested. So I took that job as part-time. So then I had two part-time jobs in Nashville and working half days at Blue Water and a lot of nights and weekends at Cracker Barrel waiting tables. And then just writing every time I could in between there. Thankfully, Blue Water gave me a reason to go to Music Row every day and to be in the music business with other music business people, making connections that way, kind of through a different door. Maybe not. A lot of those people didn't know me as a songwriter at first. They knew me as, oh, Brent, he works at Blue Water, and I was doing data entry for him, so nothing high level. Just we'd get royalty statements in, and I'd put them in the computer so that people can get paid properly, and did that for a while. So that was kind of my first kind of getting both feet planted in Nashville. And that was, I moved there in March of 2002. So a long time ago at this point.
Yeah.
I've been at it a minute. Yeah.
But that's really good, because, obviously Nashville's the type of city where, I've read some statistics. I don't want to quote them because I don't know how true they are, but I've read that you've got such an influx of people moving there daily now. Or ever since that show Nashville, actually, I believe that made people think that they can just get on a plane, go to Nashville, and suddenly be famous overnight. But the fact that you had to do these like grinding kind of jobs while you were figuring your stuff out, that's great, because I don't think. Look, obviously, some people get lucky, and that's part of this business. But I don't think it's as easy as, say, the TV show made it look. So it's good to hear that there was a slum,
Yeah, it was fun. It's funny when that show came out, and I watched the first couple episodes or something of it because I was interested in it. And some of the places were filmed like at an old publishing company of mine. Like, I've been in that room a lot.
Yeah,
and so there are things you'd see, people you recognize or whatever. But yeah, it was definitely like, that's not how it happens. No, you don't make that much money off an album cut, that kind of stuff. But I think even before, for me, it wasn't the show Nashville. So, because I predate that. So for me, one of them was this movie. It had River Phoenix in it and Sandra Bullock before she became like Sandra Bullock. It's called A Thing Called Love.
Okay.
And so it was in the 90s. And it's about these songwriters, you know, this girl moves to Nashville and whatever. And, you know, Sandra Bullock is a supporting character in it. But it had, you know, some great 90s country songs in it. And it had the Bluebird Cafe. And that's kind of what put that movie kind of helped put the Bluebird Cafe on the map. And so that was kind of my Nashville that, you know, we'd watch that movie or whatever and be like, oh, that's so great, you know. But, you know, talking about the grind, I mean, I was very fortunate that I got my first song cut, like, well, about 2 years after I moved to town.
Quick.
Which is really fast. They call it a 10-year town, and in a lot of ways, it certainly is. So for me, it happened faster than that, and that's not because I'm so much better than everybody or anything. That's just how it worked.
Yeah.
But when I was still back in Little Rock, and actually, I think I was still in grad school when I started working on this lyric for a song that would eventually become Monday Morning Church. Mm-hmm. And it was based on a poem that my mom wrote. My mom is an English teacher. She was at the time. She's retired now. But she was an English teacher, and they had one of their subjects was poetry. And they were talking about, you know, workmen's poems or poems about work. And so she just, as an example, wrote a poem about a teacher's day, because that's her job. And there's a line in it that says, you know, I walk outside at 4:30 and the parking lot's as empty as a Monday morning church or something like that. And so I was in grad school, came home one weekend, and she's like, oh, I've been writing, you know, some too. And I'm like, oh, what'd you write? You know, let me read that. I was like, that's a great image. Empty as a Monday morning church. That's really cool. I'm taking that, Mom. And she's like, okay. You know, and so I took that seed of empty as a Monday morning church and started constructing this story around it, because I'm like, I don't want to write about a teacher's day in a school parking lot. What could this be about? And started working on this lyric. And so I had it for a couple years. So I had it before I got out of college, had it when I moved to Little Rock, showed it to a couple people, nothing ever happened to it. And then through a mutual connection, heard about this girl, Erin Enderlin, who was going to school. She was from the central Arkansas area. She was from Conway. And she was going to school at MTSU, which is in Murfreesboro, which is just outside of Nashville, has a big music program there, music business program. So she was going to school there. But she's a singer-songwriter, and so they gave me a CD of some of her stuff. I'm like, yeah, she's pretty good. You know, she's several years younger than me. But that put her on my radar, because at that point, still, I don't know many people that write and want to be writers. And then I just happened to see in the local, you know, entertainment magazine or whatever, weekly, that she was going to be playing a gig at a pizza place in Little Rock. It was like over her spring break. I'm like, oh, I'm going to go out and see it, because I don't get much of that in Little Rock. So I went out and saw her and met her, and she'd actually heard my buddy Tim play out somewhere, so she kind of knew who I was a little bit. And so gave her a CD. And so then when she came back over her summer break of 2001, we started writing together. I'd go up to her place, her parents' house when she was in, and we'd write. And then she went back to school. Then over Christmas break of 2001, I brought her what I had of Monday Morning Church, and we finished it together.
Cool.
And she took it back with her to school. And then I moved to Nashville shortly after that in March of 2002. And it was the first song I ever had on hold. And probably so early, it was probably sometime in 2003, it got on hold for Leanne Womack, which was super exciting because Leanne's great. And that was my first like taste of something in the business happening with the song, because it was through Aaron's contacts. She got it to Jeff Carlton, who was a veteran publisher in Nashville and knew everybody. And it was on hold for her. And then it came off hold for her, went on hold for Terry Clark, another country artist. And I was excited about that. And It was my 2 year anniversary of moving to Nashville. So I'd not been in town that long, but I remember thinking in 2002 when I drove to Nashville, I'm driving this white Pontiac Grand Prix to Nashville, loaded up with my stuff, thinking, okay, head down and just work. And in 2 years I can come up and you kind of take a look around and go, how am I doing? But don't even have the luxury of being frustrated or anything for 2 years. 2 years come up, see what I'm doing, how things are going. So I went out, and my buddy Tim, who my old co-writer, he had moved to Nashville at that point. And so him and a couple other people went out to kind of celebrate my 2 year anniversary moving to town. You know, because like every anniversary is kind of like a big deal.
Yeah.
And I knew that Aaron had told me that Terry Clark was going in that week to cut, and our song was on hold. So I'm like, man, I got a hold. They're going in this week. You know, fingers crossed. Hope she cuts it. And so, and I didn't have a cell phone at this point. So I'm out to like 1 o'clock or whatever. I come back to the place, the same room I'm still renting from a, you know, family member. And there's a message on my answering machine. It's like, hey, Brent, this is Aaron. Got some news for you. All right. Talk to you later. I'm like, oh my gosh. She sounded like, she didn't sound sad. She wouldn't have called me if Terry didn't cut it. I think I got a Terry Clark cut.
Yeah.
Like, she must have cut. But it was like 1:30 in the morning. I'm like, I'm not going to call her, you know? So I just kind of laid there with my eyes open, not able to sleep, thinking I may have gotten my first cut. Like, all night just laying there, didn't sleep. And like 8 o'clock in the morning hits. And I'm calling Aaron. I'm like, what's up? And she's like, well, Terry didn't cut the song. I was like, oh, she goes, but Alan Jackson put it on hold. I'm like, I don't know what to do with these emotions right
now. Yeah, that's super
one
conflicting.
I thought I had like a really quality cut. My first one, it's like, no. But then you have this legend.
Yeah.
You know, Alan Jackson's like, come on.
Yeah.
Who heard it and put it on hold. So it's like, I don't know how to feel right now.
Yeah.
But it was, and of course, I just love the timing on that because that was my 2-year anniversary of moving to town. And then later that month, I got the call from Jeff, the publisher, Aaron's publisher on it, that he recorded the song. So it is a grind. It is a 10-year town. It like just kind of happened fast on that part and kicked me like 10 years into the future as far as that goes. So, I mean, it's definitely a blessing because he ended up singling it. It went top five, and Aaron was still in college when that happened. And so both of our first cuts, and people like, who are these people? Alan Jackson's a hard cut to get because he writes so much of his own stuff, but it just right song, right time, right artist, you know, just like you dream about it happening, but it did for us and got us both really into the business.
Yeah. So, you know, I want to kind of move a little forward, but before I do, so with that situation, so Aaron's publisher, is he or she the one that got that song to that particular party's radar?
Yes.
Or did you have people working for you on that respect as well?
No, man, I couldn't get anybody to work that song or any of my songs at that point. So I'd been in town and I was working at Blue Water Music. And so I met some publishers who would let me play in some songs. And so I, you know, hey, can I play some songs? And Monday Morning Church was one of the songs I'd play for him.
Cool.
Because I knew it was one of my strongest songs. And it was demoed. I didn't have too many of those either. And everybody passed on it. Like, no publishers were interested in it. Nobody jumped at it. And so Aaron had actually met Jeff Carlton in one of her classes because he came to talk to her class. And she just raised her hand and was like, can I play some songs sometime? And he just went, okay.
Cool.
And that was one of the, you know, songs she played for him. It was before it was demoed, and he's the one that actually like demoed it for, like, signed some songs, I guess, and that was on her first demo session. And you know, he believed in that song, and he's the one that pitched it around. He's the one that got the, you know, he got it to Keith Stegall, who was the one who put it on hold for all those people.
Wow.
And played for Alan. He's been Alan's producer forever. And so he's, you know, he put on hold for Leanne. Ended up not cutting any sides on her, I think. Ended up, you know, he was cutting sides on Terry, so he held it for her. Passed, it didn't work out there, and he played for Alan, and it hit him at the right time and the
amazing.
Right way.
Just amazing.
And it worked. So, you know, God bless Aaron Enderlin and Jeff Carlton, because I was trying to get somebody interested in that song, and I couldn't.
Yeah. Hey, so, it was meant to be, dude.
It was. Well, it was great because then I had my publishing on it because nobody wanted it, right? I was like trying to sign it somewhere to get my, you know, to get something going, and nobody wanted it. And that's a lesson I tell people, is like, that's the music business in a nutshell.
Oh, yeah.
On one hand, you have one publisher believes in it, demoing, he's pitching it, it's getting on hold here and there, and then I'm playing it for whoever I can, and it's just, yeah, pretty good. It's really sad. I'm like, I know. What else you got? And you know, they weren't wrong. I can look at it now with the experience I have and realize, yeah, it's really country. It's a ballad. Like, it is a slow song. It's sad. It's really sad. And the singer you know, even talks about kind of yelling at God.
Yeah.
And, you know, in country music, very conservative, very Bible belt. I'm like, yeah, I can see why this wouldn't get cut.
Yeah.
But that was a song that was in there, and we just wrote it the best we could. And Aaron loved it. It's that song. So it's right up her alley. But it's like, oh, I can see why that's a miracle that it got to the right person and ended up doing as well as it did. So, yeah, it's like, yeah, people pass on stuff, and then it goes top five. Welcome to Nashville. That's why you don't take just one person's opinion on it as everything. Kind of what I tell people is don't take no from somebody who can't say yes.
That's great.
Because, like, publishers that passed on it, they can give you a yes, but they can't give you the big yes. Who could give me the big yes? Alan Jackson can give me the big yes because he can cut what he wants to.
Exactly.
Or Garth Brooks or Morgan Wallen or whoever, like, these people can give you the big yes. Anybody else, their no is just a no for them, but it's not the no. The only person that can really say no to my song permanently is me.
Exactly.
Because I stop working, I stop believing it. Nobody else can say, so I just try not to take a no from somebody who can't give me the big yes.
Yeah, that's great advice. So now we shoot forward dramatically. At this point, you know, you've built a career, you've recorded or had songs recorded by Alan Jackson, mm-hmm. Lady Antebellum, Randy Travis, Jewel, Lone Star. I mean, credits that would take me far too long to list. But I will post-interview. So I want to kind of like dissect or segue a few different topics here, if you'd entertain this.
Great, yeah.
First question. Let's talk about writing rooms and how you go about communicating splits within your writing sessions.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly what your process is in this regard, because, you know, I'm lucky. I've done some writing. I know how it's worked for me, but I've also spoken to some people and it doesn't seem to work the same for them. So what's your process? Do you go in there and kind of, if it's someone you've not worked with, do you lay on the table straight away how it's going to be? Is it assumed that it's going to be 50-50 if it's only two people? Or is it something you discuss after the song's written? How do you do it?
Yeah. I tell you, I can't remember the last time I had a discussion about splits with somebody or did anything other than straight even splits, like well over a decade.
Cool.
Just in Nashville, the way we do it is just it's assumed equal splits among all the people in the room that are working on the song. That's it. We don't even talk about it.
Awesome.
Never comes up, and it's just assumed. So that's the very Nashville way of doing it. Now, I'm also working with people that are artists or published writers. Like, they're all professionals at this point. So we don't need to have that conversation. If somebody wants to have it, probably because something unusual is going on here. So that's very much a country and even like Southern gospel, bluegrass, you know, just very normal or CCM kind of way of doing it. So we don't even talk about it. We just get everyone's information, you know, hey, who's your publishing by whatever. We just get that information, but we don't even discuss splits. It's just assumed. Now, if you're starting out, have those discussions early. Just go, hey, just want to say everybody in the room equal splits, right? That's how I operate. And that way, if somebody's newer and they have another mindset, you can go ahead and flush that out early because it's a lot easier to do that early in the process before feelings start getting involved or egos or whatever. So we don't even talk about it anymore. I know in some other places like L.A. or pop music, hip-hop, that can be a very different thing. Going back to my experience at Blue Water, we admin for some, you know, for song, a bunch of other publishing companies. And so we had some hip hop catalog too. And some of those splits are crazy.
Hmm.
Like, you know, 12 riders and this guy's got 2% and they got 4 and they got 8 and they, you know, whatever, it all adds up to 100%. But it's like, what is going on in these rooms? Whereas normally at that point it was unusual even to have three people, you know, back in the early 2000s. But now it's most of what I do are like three-way rights, but it's just okay, all thirds, there we go. We have a saying, you know, word for a third, which is kind of like a joke that. But it means like, hey, everyone, you contribute, you're in the room, you get even splits, because what goes around comes around. You may not contribute as much this time, or I may not as much this time, but I will over contribute next time. It's going to even out over the long term. If it's not, I'll probably stop being in those rooms if I'm carrying everything, or if I'm not contributing enough, they're going to stop inviting me into those rooms. So it's just, it's going to work out. And so we don't have to sweat it so much. And also my theory on song splits, one thing I love about it just being equal no matter what, is if you and I are having a discussion about a line and what the better line is, what line we needed to go with, I know that we are both serving the song. I don't have it in the back of my mind going, is he serving his percentage or am I serving my percentage? Because, you know, I got some extra bills that popped up, and so this would be good if I get a little bit more. Like, it's not part of it. Now, you may still have ego, and, like, I want this line. You still have to, you know, watch out for that. But it's not the financial stuff. Like, if we take care of the song will take care of all of us evenly. Let's just get the best song. I'm angling for the best line, not my best percentage. And so we're not, you know, counting lines, going, who did what lines? Because, for one thing, well, that last line, you might have said the final iteration of that line, but you wouldn't have gotten there without what I said before that. Exactly. And I would have gotten there without what you said before that or what the third person said. It's like it's all this, you know, this mix, amalgamation of all this. Like none of it would be here if we weren't all here. Nobody can take – we all own it. For good or bad, every line is your line, my line, her line, his line. It's like it's all ours. And so I like not having to worry about that part of it. And it makes the math easier, too. You don't have to have those conversations.
Yeah, that's actually
but that's
really
very
nice.
Much a natural way. If you're starting out, have those conversations, get used to it, just because you don't know maybe where the other people are at.
Yeah.
So your mileage may vary.
Second question.
Yes.
Once a song is finished, splits are decided, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, how do you personally get your songs pitched? Do you go directly to the artist, knowing that you have a network of artists at this point in your career? Or does it all come together with the team behind you, like your publishers or your, in nowadays, I suppose, if you're pitching for TV, sync agents, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Again, what's your experience?
Yeah, I'm an all hands on deck kind of guy. So a lot of times I do write with artists these days, you know, artists of varying levels. They may be independent artists. They may be label artists. They may be whatever kind of room I can put together. And so a lot of it these days, there's not as, and I speak mainly from the country point of view, the country industry, there's not as much pitching of outside songs. Outside meaning the artist or producer is not a writer on the song. Like it's coming from the outside. They don't have a stake in it financially. So hopefully with the stake they have in it is this is an amazing song. So I don't write as many of those. It still happens on occasion, but the big wins, and this is for most publishers these days, are trying to build a room like with a producer in it or an artist, or preferably an artist and a producer in it.
Yeah.
Because that way, you know, we're talking about don't take a no from someone who can't say yes. Like you get to skip a lot of those no's, possible no's, if you're writing with the artist and the producer. You can, instead of saying, I think the artist would say this, you just look at the artist and go, would you say this? And so that's a lot of what I have a publisher friend of mine who said, you know, he doesn't do nearly as much song plugging or pitching as he used to. Now he's a calendar jockey. You know, he's putting together rooms. He's working calendars for his writers to put him in position to win. So that's a lot of it is writing with people that hopefully they're the outlet. Or even if we want to pitch it, maybe they're an artist, but they're not a major artist. They may put it out or you may pitch it, you know, but there's still some sort of outlet in the room. We're writing for them. So I like that a lot just because it's better batting average. You know, just you know the outlet and it's going, hey, what do you want to say? What's going on with you? Which is fun. On those other days when I'm writing to pitch, then, yeah, man, if I can get it directly to an artist, I'll pitch it to an artist. I'm self-published these days. So, but a lot of my co-writers may have publishers. And so it was like, hey, what does your team think? Do we want to demo this? Sometimes my co-writers can produce and sing and can do a full demo themselves. Other times not, and we'll just have to get, you know, publishers and everyone on board to sign off on spending the money.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to get to who I can get it to, whether it's labels, A&R people, producers, artists, and so are my co-writers and their teams.
Cool.
Trying to get it. So we're just all kind of scrambling, if we believe in a song, to try and get it heard.
Yeah.
Which is not a gimme, you know, which is not a definite going to happen kind of thing. Everyone's trying to, and again, it's really low percentage. That's almost plan B. you know, it's taken some of the bloom off the rose. Cause when I first moved to town, it was mainly writing with other writers, not many artist writes. Cause this was also before streaming really took off. It was more Napster days, you know, it was Napster and MySpace days. And so there wasn't the option you have now of going, hey, you know what? The artist in the room with me may not be signed, but they may put it down and get a couple hundred thousand streams on it. I can still make a little bit of money off of it, which makes it a cash flow positive day. And then we can still pitch it or whatever. Before, it was mainly just writing with other writers in the room and hoping our publisher liked it and would demo it and pitch it. And we're going to try and get it to, you know, whoever at the time, Tim McGraw, Kenny Chesney, who are still the people now you still want to get it to.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's changed quite a bit that way, where there's a lot more emphasis on getting in the room, you know, building a room.
Cool. Like, yeah.
So it's changed quite a bit.
Well, so that might make my third kind of segue from my original question a little bit redundant, but
okay.
I was going to ask the overall sonic quality. I've heard various things, you know. I've heard that if you're a respected enough writer and you find a song or write a song that you believe can go to artist A, B, or C, and you have a relationship with them, that sometimes you can send that song. Just as in, like, it's rough form, you got to check this out, we need it, like, done ASAP kind of thing. And they listen to it and go, oh my God, I got to track this song. But right. Then other times I've heard that song needs to be, like I moved here from London and I was with a publisher, and I remember when I would send her songs, dude, if that song wasn't 100% produced to the point that all you had to do was remove the voice, there was no way yeah. she was pitching it. And it became quite tough because, like, you know, again, unless you find yourself in these situations where, hey, this guy's a mixing engineer and this guy's a producer and we can all get together and make a team, like, I started to find the workload quite intimidating because it was like the writing, I felt like I could really churn those out. Oh, man, here's a song. What do you think? Oh, yeah, right. I got to produce it. Okay, well, now I need an extra week just for that song. Oh, okay, right. And then you got to mix it. Oh, now I need an extra 2 days. And it's like it became like my productivity level seemed to just dwindle. And suddenly I was like, man, I've spoken to dudes in the States, and this was before I moved to the States, that, like, they said they just had to send a voice recording. So, but, you know, I think you might have just covered that. So if you did with the thing, I'm sorry.
I can dive into that for sure. And it's really case dependent. Depends on the song. Depends on the writer, the relationship they have with the artist who they can get it to. Like, if you're an unknown writer and you have what we would call a work tape, which is the rough, you know, you record it on your iPhone, voice memo, the day you write it, you know, still brand new, fresh, you know, you're still having to read the lyric because you don't know it yet. And so you're unknown and you're not going to be able to get it to a Morgan Wallen, right? You don't have those relationships. So if you're lucky, you're going to get it to like five or six people down the chain, down the ladder. And it's probably going to be somebody who's, you know, they don't know you, and they're probably not going to be able to hear a hit in a work tape because it's not produced. Mm. It's like a guitar and a voice, and it's rough. You know, it's not mixed and none of that stuff, right? And so the chance of them hearing it, even if it's worthy, you know, and could be a hit, boy, there's a lot of people who are going to have to hear through that. Whereas if you're, say, like a Tony Lane, who's an established writer, hit songwriter, and, like, he's an artist, like, he's really cool. Like, he's got this cool, really distinctive style and voice. I love hearing him, like, play out and hearing his version of songs. He's got a thing. You know, he sells it. That's the thing. He's not a guy that would win American Idol. Like, he doesn't have those kind of, he's not Chris Stapleton vocally. But he's a stylist, and he's great at what he does, and he sells it. So he could send a song directly to an artist because he's been around long enough, had those. And he's so cool that he can do like just a little work tape or something. And it's going to be really freaking cool.
Amazing.
And you're going to know it's great. And that could work because Blake Shelton himself or Tim McGraw, whoever, could hear it and go, man, that's awesome. Because
yeah.
he can sell it. So that's part of it. Can you sell it? Can you get it to a person who can say yes? And if it's a big, you know, Jason Aldean stadium rock song, you probably need more than just the guitar vocal.
Yeah.
Like, you need something to sell oh, this is supposed to be for 15 or 20,000 people in an arena. That's this kind of thing. And it's demoed up that way. That's going to need more of that than just like the work tape in the room.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And a lot of people these days are, you know, we call them track guys or track girls who are producer writers. And so I'm writing with one tomorrow and with him and an artist. And so what we're going to do is try to write a song for her. And then he's going to, if we deem it worthy, his extra time, he'll go and he'll start building a great track and send it to her for her vocals.
Cool.
And sometimes you're doing that in the room with people where they're just got their rig and they're building the track and you can sing it and leave with like pretty good demo. And you can go, yeah, this is the vibe. This is it. Other times they may come back to you, but it moves things along a lot more efficiently. It's cheaper. It's more cost effective than hiring a band than we used to do. So the turnaround can be a lot more. But it really just depends on the song and where you can get it to as far as what you can get away with on that.
That makes a lot of sense. I'm going to flip the script slightly, but a weird one.
Go.
Let's say you've got all your experience and your know-how, all your years of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
You decide that you have to start building your career from scratch. What's your approach?
So I know what I know, but
you know what
I don't
you know, but you don't have contacts, you don't have anything.
Right.
I don't know. Let's go back 20 years, 22 years.
Yeah.
You're moving from Arkansas to Nashville. But you have the knowledge you now have. What do you do? What's your approach?
I would be hitting up the writer's nights for sure. I would be following people on socials. Just so if I have songs, like I have some songs now, I'd be using those as bait. What I did when I first moved to Nashville is I was carrying around, you know, cassette tapes with some songs on them with my lyrics, you know, and my contact information rubber banded to them. And I'd go out to writer's nights and I was thankful like Aaron – you know, so I knew her, right? Because I started writing with her before I moved to Nashville. So she would go play writers around somewhere. So I was keeping in contact. Where are you playing? So I'm playing at the French Quarter. Great. I'm going to go there and I'm going to see who's playing on either side of her. Hopefully she plays our song. Maybe she will. Maybe she won't. I'm going to check out the people on either side of her. If I dig what they do, I'm going to come up to them and say, hey, I'm Brent. I ride with Aaron. Oh, hey, I'm Anthony. And Anthony, by the way, is still one of my best friends, 20 something years later. Hey, we should ride sometime. Yeah, because I did what you do. I like what you did, you know. And since I wasn't playing out myself, if you're playing out, if you're a performer, if you can play out, do that. Go to the writer's nights, meet the other people, get there early, stay there late, shake a lot of hands and do the whole, like, hey, what's your Insta? Let me reach out to you and just try to set up rooms that way with whoever you can. So there'd be a lot of that if I were moving there. It's a lot of nights out, meeting people, checking out what they have on socials. Whatever I could do to have a presence on social, to be discoverable, so I have something to share with people, so I can show my work and, hey, here's what I'm doing. So start getting songs, start trying to get some good recordings of them, and, you know, approach people with, hey, I got an idea. And I got an idea I think would be great for you as an artist. You know, there's so many independent artists out there, and just try to throw an idea or something down to try and hook them. If they don't know you, you have nothing to recommend you. And just try to be a good, genuine person and build a lot of relationships. I have a coffee mug that, I mean, it's one of my own. It's my own merch, but it says, you know, three steps to songwriting success. Write great songs, build strong relationships, repeat. Those are the three steps. Write great songs, build strong relationships, repeat. And so I would dive into that, and opportunities are going to come from that. And, you know, be patient. Aim for people that are working hard and smart. You know, you can't want somebody else's career more than they do. They may have talent, but if they're not working hard, if they're not going about things in a good way, that probably isn't a wise investment.
Yeah, that's true.
There have been plenty of times I've invested in artists that were talented, but they maybe just didn't have the drive, the want to, all the other skill sets they needed. I wouldn't spend as much time on those artists and go, okay, but this one over here is talented and really hungry. Okay, let's try that. Because I have a lot of songs on a lot of shelves with artists that, like, that sounds great, it's good stuff, but I should have known better, which is hard.
Oh, yeah. Songs, hard drives full of songs that no one will hear. It's heartbreaking stuff, man.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
What are your overall thoughts on the invents of AI, and how do you think it's affecting songwriters, if at all?
I'm sure it's some people are using it. I haven't ever really used it for songwriting. So I've gotten on the ChatGPT and just checked it out, and I've had some fun. I have several kids, and so I've had fun with them and just gone there and said, hey, write a poem about, you know, one of my kids' names who has this hobby or this funny personal trait. You know, we just make stuff up and he would just kick it right out. And there once was a boy named Ozzy who put it, you know, and we'd laugh about it, that sort of thing. And a couple of times I put in, like, after I'd write a song, I'd put it in a ChatGPT, like, hey, give me a country lyric with this title about this kind of thing. And just like, what is it? What's it going to kick out?
Exactly, yeah.
And, you know, I've never seen anything that's remote, you know, it's not there. It's, okay, good. That's not competition yet.
Yeah.
But there have been a few things where I've seen it kick out something that I'm like, oh, I've heard worse.
Yeah.
From humans.
That's
okay.
True.
Okay. So, you know, it's only going to get better. You know, I don't know if I think it will, how it may help some people who have a really hard time with a blank page. Like, if they have an idea, but they just don't know how to get going on it, then they maybe will say, hey, here's a title and here's a general idea. Give me this, write a lyric for this. And they may kick something out. There may be something in there that goes, oh, now I got something to fix.
Exactly. Yeah.
I go, okay, that might be a, you know, there may be a line that go, oh, that's interesting. You know, it may just be a way to generate some scratch paper at the beginning. But I, you know, of course, I don't ever use it like that. But I've played around with it to see what there is there, and
yeah,
has been worth the time. You know, I never think about it. I should probably try it more and just see if, like, if I'm not sure how to crack an idea, like, I'll just put it in and just see if there's a line that sparks something.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different elements of it now. In fact, I was talking to a musician, a bass player, a little bit earlier, and he was saying that, like, we were talking about how, you know, how if you get your song licensed to a movie, per se, how often those supervisors want all the separate files, the WAVs, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes as musicians, even if we've paid for that recording and we own the master, or a songwriter, we own the master, we don't always, or not every musician is smart enough to get those separate WAVs when they first start recording. So you land up with a song 20 years later and you go, this is a really good song. Ah, shit, I don't have the...
I don't have the bass by itself.
Exactly.
I don't have the, yeah.
And like he was telling me about an app, I feel like it was called Track Junkie or something like that. I could be wrong. That you shove your song in there, dissects everything, takes off all the effects. And I'm just like, what? Like, so
that's cool.
In that respect, incredible, right? But
yeah,
there's some stuff I'm hearing from some of like my production music friends that definitely make me think, that job sounds like it might be a few years away from extinction. And I'm not hoping so. I hope not. But the production music stuff sounds like it's getting very scary.
That's interesting, too, because, you know, I thought it more from, you know, just a writing side. But I know that, you know, some of these I've heard about where they're like, hey, write Ed Sheeran type song with Kanye West on vocals or what, you know, and there's some that do that kind of stuff. I'm like, that's really creepy.
Scary.
Yeah. It's like, oh, could you do that to say, write a, you know, Morgan Wallen type song with this title? And like, is it going to get the thing where like you just give it the inputs and it does and you got a whole demo and it sounds like him singing or, you know, I don't know. I mean, I guess it'll get there.
Dude, yeah.
How good will it be? Will it have the heart? Will it have the, you know, somebody said about technology, like when drum machines came out, people were like, oh my gosh, the drummer's going to be out of business because now you can put it in, it's perfectly in time. It's on the grid. It's there. It's perfect, right? It's digital. It's not off at all. And that worked for a while, but then they started wanting that human element, like somebody who's a little behind the beat, those little imperfections that the soul, the heart, and it's like, it's not perfect, but it's great.
Yeah.
You know, it's better than perfect.
Exactly.
It's human. And so then you needed the person. And so, I don't know. We'll see if it can get to, and I think maybe for different genres, it will have different effects. You know, how much heart is in a lyric versus, hey, you know, if it's a dance thing where the lyrics are so, it doesn't matter, just some catchy phrases. Okay, maybe it's going to take that faster than a storytelling with the surprise, you know, with all this heart. I don't know.
Time will tell, you know.
I'll just keep on chugging. Hope I hit the dirt before that takes my job.
Me too, man. I know that from your socials and just from your podcasts and stuff, some of those kinds of things, that the art of songwriting is something you're extremely passionate about.
Yeah.
You know, the mug, the cap, all that stuff. It's
great.
Yeah. So let's say that a writer feels that they are competent with that aspect. They feel like they've got the craft down to a point.
Mm-hmm.
They're writing really great songs, or at least they believe they're writing really great songs. Yes. What do you feel are aspects of the business that they should potentially try and educate themselves on away from just trying to create good art?
Yes. So, you know, write great songs, build strong relationships, repeat. If you're what you call a public writer versus a private writer. I just had did an episode on my podcast, The Climb, with a buddy of mine, a songwriter and songwriting educator, Steve Leslie. And that's a phrase he put, are you a public writer or a private writer? If you're a public writer, you're writing for the public. Like I am. I'm a public songwriter. I want my songs to be heard by millions of people. I'm not just writing for myself. So if you want your songs to be heard and be in the commercial marketplace, okay, what are the avenues to do that? Are you an artist? You know, you need to know the business if you want to be in business. If it's a hobby and you just want, it's just to enrich your personal life, that's awesome. You're already winning if you're having a good time. That's great. If you want to monetize it, you're going into a business. It's a business that's super competitive. You need to learn the business and you need to shake a lot of hands. You need to know people because, like, songs, like, they travel hand to hand. It may be a digital hand through an email inbox, but they travel on relationships. I look at the analogy of, like, the song is a boat. And you can have an amazing yacht or, like, an amazing speedboat, whatever, but the water is going to travel. It's going to sit there if it's in a dry riverbank. The relationships are the water. Like, that boat's not going anywhere. It travels on relationship. And so you got to have both. You got to have enough relationships to float that boat for that song to travel on. Otherwise, it's not going anywhere. No one's going to hear it. Or you may have a lot of relationships, but if your boat has a lot of holes in it because your craft isn't there, your songs aren't there, it's just going to sink, and no one's going to hear it either. So it takes both. You want to build good craft, well-crafted boats, and you want to put a lot of water in that river, a lot of relationships, and then you can move, and then it can get heard, and because it travels on relationships. So that's a lot of it, is learning, like, how did the business work? Who are the, like, what's the structure of whatever, say, genre you're in? Who are the people that can say yes? Who do you need to know? That's part of the reason why I think why co-writing is so prevalent in the music business is for many reasons, but part of it is that's how you get to know people a lot. Like, most of the people I know is because I've been in the writer's room with them, or I got introduced to somebody through that relationship with that person. And that's, you know, it's shaking hands and like, oh, so-and-so's looking for songs. Oh, I didn't know that. Thank you for telling me as we're writing a song together. I can't get it to them, but you can. And who do we get it to? And just, it's all that stuff. So it's really learning the people side of the business and always working to build good quality relationships and an honest way, not taking advantage of people, but, you know, trying to bring value. That's another thing, is like, people have a lot of options. You want to be a good option for them to spend time with, to write a song with. And so what's the value of what I can bring to the room, not what's the value I can extract from the room?
That's
like
great.
Don't worry so much, like, what can these people do for me? Yes, you want to move forward into the business, you want to climb up the ladder, we all do, that's fine, there's nothing wrong with that. I'm very ambitious, like, I want cuts and I want hits, and, you know, I have family to feed. But if you're only worried about yourself, you make it much harder on yourself. But if I come into a write, say, with an artist, instead of like, how can I get the artist to cut my song? If I look at it, go, how can I serve the artist? How can I help them tell their story? How can I help them feel good while we're writing this, to have a good experience and to write a song that's going to And if they're smart, they're thinking, how can I serve my audience?
Yeah.
So I'm like, how can I help the artist in the room with me serve their audience? So like, we're all in the service business. I'm not in the taking business. I'm in the serving business. So working with an artist, if I help them serve their audience, like, hey, I'm here to help you serve your audience. You serve your audience, they pay your bills. And if I help you serve them, my bills get paid along the way. And I think it was Zig Ziglar. He was a sales and motivational speaker in the years. Yeah. He said something to the effect of like, if you help enough people, like you can get anything you want out of life if you help enough people get what they want. So that's the deal. Like every time I've succeeded, something good has happened to me. It's because I've helped somebody get what they want. Alan Jackson is looking for a hit. I help like serve this up, like maybe this. And he's like, yes, I think that solves my problem. Like I'm always looking for a hit or any cut I've had because they saw that song as a solution for a problem they have. I need a great song. I need a hit or whatever, a song for this situation or song for that. Or if I'm writing with somebody because I'm in the room because they think I can solve a problem. I need an idea. I need, you know, that next great idea or need what, or I have part of the scene, but I'm not sure where to go with it lyrically. Call Brent. So hopefully I show up as a solution for people, not a problem. So that's a big mindset thing is like, what can I give?
Great, great way to look at it. Brent, I know we're coming to the end, so I have two last questions for you, sir.
Yes.
First question, or second last question, depending on how you want to paraphrase it.
Yes.
What do you think has been the hardest part about being a songwriter for you?
The ups and the downs, not, you know, because it's a roller coaster, so there's way more no's than yeses. So just keeping your head in it, grinding, you know, being able to keep doing it for a living is challenging. And for another thing, just not letting it consume my life. So I'm a lot more balanced now than I used to be. There have been plenty of times where I was not the best husband because it's such a, in a way, it's such a grind of a business and it's so competitive and so hard to get that next little bit of maybe success that you can spend way too much time on that and not enough time with family and that kind of stuff. So things have gone better for me as a husband, as a father, when I have much more balance. And a lot of that just comes down to faith that like, if I take care of the things God has given me to take care of, he's going to take care of me. So that's one of the big challenges is not for one, I love it. Two, it's super hard. And three, you know, there's always more to be done. So learning when to close the laptop has been a challenge. So yeah, I'd say that's probably been the hardest part, most challenging thing.
Good answer. And possibly a little bit of a loaded question.
Okay.
What do you think has been the best piece of advice you've either ever received or figured out along the way in regards to being a songwriter for yourself personally?
Man, best part. So much good advice. I think it is that build great songs, you know, build strong, write great songs, build strong relationships, repeat, and just keep doing the process. Just keep trusting the process. Go out, make, you know, build relationships, authentic relationships, make friends, write the best songs you can. Yeah, definitely pay attention to what your goal is of, you know, do I want to write commercial songs? Then focus on writing commercial, the best commercial songs you can and get as many people to hear them as possible and through your relationships. And just remember that you're in the service business. Like, how can I serve the people around me? If I keep serving them, they'll always be happy to see me.
Yeah.
If I solve their problems, they're never mad to see me coming. You know, so they'll always be happy to, and that keeps you, you know, keeps them coming back and gives you a reason to keep coming back as well. So serve people, write great songs, build strong relationships, and repeat.
Excellent. Brent Baxter, dude, thank you so much. I will put all of your links in my show notes, as I'm sure you know how that all works. It's been an honor, dude. I feel like I know you, but I think it's because I've listened to so many of your podcasts. So I don't mean that in a strange way, but it's been a privilege talking to you, man. I can't thank you enough for your time. And if you ever come down to New Orleans, hit me up, man. We'll go get some beignets or something.
Oh, I love New Orleans. Yes, thank you.
Amazing. All right, dude. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, take care.
Bye. There we go. Another episode done and dusted. I'd like to publicly thank Brent Baxter for his time. I'd like to thank each and every one of you for your time. I truly appreciate the support. I know I say it at the top of every episode, but please leave us a rating or review on your preferred streaming network. And if you feel so inclined, share these episodes with your like-minded, creative, individual-type friends. You can find out more about me. My name is Travis Mark at travismark.com. You can find out more about the Musician's Mentor Podcast at musicians-mentorpodcast.com. I appreciate it. Keep pushing. And I'll see you on the next one. Peace.